Cabral, who is a research engineer with the USGS at the Leetown Science Center in Kearneysville, West Virginia. He is currently investigating the application of acid mine drainage ochres for the recovery of phosphate from agricultural and municipal wastewaters. Prior to his employment with the USGS, Dr. Cabral worked at the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Bureau of Mines, and in the mining industry as an engineer conducting research on resource recovery and environmental restoration. He is also a professional engineer, has over 100 publications and presentations. He received his B.S. from the Colorado School of Mines and M.S. and Ph.D.s from the University of Utah in metallurgical engineering. Let's welcome Phil.
Well, thank you, Gary. Before I get started on my talk, I'd like to thank Gary and the symposium organizers to give me the chance to share my research results with you today. I've been working on two environmental issues in the Mid-Atlantic region for quite a while now, and these are acid mine drainage and phosphate pollution. Now, at first, it didn't seem like there was going to be a lot of overlap between those two areas, but the more we worked on it, it seemed like there would be. And I'll be talking about that here. And at this point, it looks like it's fairly promising that we can have a positive impact on both those areas with this idea. So I'll move on. Problem one, I probably don't have to dwell on that with this audience. Excess phosphorus runoff is a problem. Any animal feeding operation, any fertilizer running off the field is going to lead to eutrophication, harmful algal blooms, things like that. That's a problem in Chesapeake Bay in my neck of the woods where I'm from. But it also is a worldwide issue. And the second problem, acid mine drainage, which maybe you guys aren't as familiar with, but anytime you dig up pyrite, anytime you expose pyrite to air and moisture, you can generate acid mine drainage. As a matter of fact, it's not always even mining. Anytime you're exposing that pyrite to the atmosphere and the water, you can get in a road cut, for example. That was something that happened at Penn State when they built a new highway to town there. They actually hit some rock with pyrite in it, and they had acid rock drainage right there. And what I want to point out here is one of the products, even after the water gets neutralized, is this iron hydroxy compound. We have too much of it. We have a picture down here where a plume of that iron oxide is contaminating the stream. This is in western Maryland, near where I work as well. And so that makes that habitat unsuitable for trout and other aquatic animals. So we have these two environmental issues, too much phosphorus, too much iron oxide. What can we do about that? All right, well, let's look at phosphorus removal technology. Best available technology right now when somebody tells you you've got to remove phosphorus from your water is the addition of iron or aluminum salts to the water. So this incurs a fair amount of cost because you have to buy those reagents initially. You have to have a liquid-solid separation capacity because what these things do when you add them to the water, they precipitate, they form a flock blanket that settles down through the water that pulls down any particulates and also absorbs any phosphorus, or hopefully most of the phosphorus that's soluble in the water. And it also requires disposal of the resulting sludge, and a lot of times you don't get the phosphorus back of that, so it's difficult to recycle the phosphorus. Now, in municipal wastewater treatment systems, you can use biological phosphorus uptake, where the microorganisms do the work for you and pull up XSP. This is a more complicated system to run than the standard wastewater treatment process. So it's more expensive, it's more difficult, so it's harder to maintain, and it's difficult to retrofit to existing plants. So our new concept I want to explore today is phosphorus sorption in a fixed bed. And so where we're going to use these excess iron oxides from acid mine drainage, it's good because a fixed bed process allows you to add that to an existing system, and we can recover and recycle the phosphorus, close that recycle loop, and no liquid solid separation required. So I'm fortunate, I guess, in my region of the country, in the Mid-Atlantic, that the acid mine drainage and phosphorus sources overlap. I live in the Potomac River and Shenandoah River drainage, and we have quite a bit of phosphorus input to the Chesapeake Bay in that drainage, and that is causing serious issues in Chesapeake Bay that we've been working on for years. Also, in western Pennsylvania and central West Virginia here, we've got the Appalachian coal fields with all that coal mining. Very often you're going to pull out, when you mine that coal, you're going to pull out pyrite, just a few percent, and that overburden material will result in mine drainage. And so there are over 5,000 stream miles in the Appalachian region that have been affected by or impacted by acid mine drainage. So these two problems are co-located near where I'm working. I worked on one initially on mine drainage, and then we said, what are we going to do with all these iron oxides? And then we started looking at phosphorus sorption. My button isn't working. How about space bar? Got it. Let's try it. Yeah, there. Good, good. Okay, so in acid mine drainage, a couple of gurus in the area, Bob Hedden and Jim Gusick, have come up with this treatment flow sheet for almost all different kinds of acid mine drainage. And I want to point out, any of these red circles are settling ponds where you're going to get those iron hydroxides. And so almost any way you treat acid mine drainage, you're going to get these iron hydroxides because, remember, it's formed from sulfide, which is an iron mineral. And there's a lot of it out there. This is from a treatment site. It's called Brandy Camp. It's in western Pennsylvania near Brockport. And I just want to show the scale of the amount of material that's out there that's just going to waste. At best, you can leave it in place there. At worst, that's you have to pay to send it to a landfill or things like that. So this is an excess material that there's no use for. And in some cases, for acid mine drainage treatment, disposal of that resulting sludge is a significant part of the cost. So what's in these mine drainage jokers? This is a whole rock analysis. In other words, we digest the rock down, analyze it, and then we express the major elements as oxides. The good thing about this analysis is you should get 100% for most common rocks and minerals. And as you'd expect, most of the mine drainage samples, like this Blue Valley one here, have quite a bit of iron oxide. That's the orange. Aluminum oxide also has phosphorus sorption capacity, so if they have lots of orange and yellow, that would be a good ochre for phosphorus sorption capacity or for phosphorus sorption applications. But in some cases, like this sample here at Bab Creek, that was a sampling problem. We got quite a bit of silicates because we dug into the liner and the stream sediments when you're getting the ochre sample. So that was not a good sorption candidate. This LCN sample, they were not a very sophisticated operation, adding way more lime than they probably should have been doing. And so that is very calcium-rich material, doesn't have a lot of iron oxides in it. So how can we tell if these ochres are going to be a good candidate for phosphorus sorption? And the composition alone doesn't really tell you everything. What you need is to look at the sorption capacity via these isotherms. Whoops. And you can, these are some of the samples we analyzed that I showed in the previous slide. Most of my samples are from western Pennsylvania. And you can see we got a coal ash sample just to see what would happen with coal ash. That's right there. It had very little sorption capacity. As we looked at some of our different samples, we actually had several that had very good sorption capacity up here. And so we're encouraged to move ahead with those samples. I'll be focusing on that the Blue Valley sample. A lot of our results were done with that. And so you might be thinking, well, why? How is this isotherm so useful? Why don't you just show us percent removal or things like that? Well, what it turns out is when you combine the isotherm with the mass balance, and that's what this operating line There it is. The operating line here is essentially a mass balance. In other words, you start out with a certain concentration of phosphorus in the water, and based on the solid-liquid ratio, you'll get these various lines that will tell you the point where they cross indicates your equilibrium condition. So if you add more media, you're going to get a lower loading, but you're going to remove more of the phosphorus. And you can actually see that happening in this previous slide where we have various ochres. We started out at 20 milligrams per liter, say down here, and the coal ash very little, so they all fall in this line here. So that's it's a very useful tool to allow you to predict what's going to happen in any batch test, what your equilibrium condition is going to be. Okay, but the capacity isn't everything. Kinetics are important too. Generally, the faster the better. The faster the kinetics, the smaller your equipment needs to be, and the more economical it's going to be. So our samples here, and by the way, these are for granular samples. If we had done this with a powdered sample, it would all be over in a matter of a few minutes. But this gives us time to compare and contrast different media that we've used. We're able to linearize those results too. And that tells us something about the mechanism of sorption. I don't have time to get into that, but that is another avenue of investigation. So knowing the kinetics and the thermodynamics of the sorption process, how do we design our equipment to remove phosphorus continuously from wastewater? So this is our laboratory setup. We've used, in this case, a 1-inch glass chromatography column. Our phosphorus is a synthetic solution in the groundwater that we have at the Leetown Science Center in West Virginia. That's in karst terrain. It's got quite a bit of calcium in there, about 120 milligrams per liter calcium. We're pumping that through there with a peristaltic pump, this Masterflex pump right here, and sampling it periodically to see what kind of removal we're getting. And how do we evaluate the removal in a fixed bed column like this? Well, it's the breakthrough curve. And in this case, this schematic here, the water is coming in to the top of the reactor. It's difficult to get this arrow. I'm going to use your pointer instead. There it is. Okay. So the water's coming in the top here. And the media absorbs the phosphorus as it comes in, but after a while the media gets saturated. It's like a sponge. There's only so much phosphorus it can absorb before all the sites are saturated. So there's an absorption zone here, and as time goes on, that absorption zone goes down. Meanwhile, you're getting most of your phosphorus out right here. But as your absorption zone approaches the bottom of the column, then you'll start to see the phosphorus break through, and eventually the whole column will be saturated. So what you want to see is a fairly flat performance right here until you get your capacity, then it goes up pretty quickly. That would be desirable. So here's what we got in our experiments in the lab, each of these in that 1-inch chromatography column. So if you bring in the phosphorus at a high concentration and a high flow rate, you're going to saturate very quickly in a matter of days. As you slow down that flow or you decrease the phosphorus concentration, it will take longer before it saturates. But what we found gave us really superior results is when we decrease the particle size of the media. These samples here were about 1/2 to 4 millimeter in size. We cut this down a little bit more. It's in terms of mesh, 20 to 50 mesh. We're up to about 30 days here, we have almost complete removal of the phosphorus at that point. Then we start to see the breakthrough. So that's the kind of performance you want to see in a commercial phosphorus removal system, a fixed bed application. Notice also all this data, we're able to model performance given the conditions and develop the parameters we needed for the homogeneous surface diffusion model, which we used and is depicted by the lines here. And that allows us to predict and to design treatment systems for water this media in this water in any other size that we might want to do. So it's a very useful model to have to be able to predict what's going to happen. Okay, so now we've saturated our media with phosphorus. What are we going to do now? Well, fortunately, this is a reversible reaction. We can strip the phosphorus off the media by increasing the pH. In this case, this is a 0.1 molar solution of sodium hydroxide, and this is the elution curve. We loaded this column up over a period of about 3 months, and you can see that we removed most of the phosphorus. In this case, we get about 76% of the phosphorus off. We removed it within a period of 12 hours, and we concentrated it significantly. The phosphorus going into these columns was about 0.1 milligrams per liter, and we've concentrated up to 100 at the peak. So it we've recovered that phosphorus in the water and concentrated it into our strip solution there. We've also regenerated the media by doing so, and we've enabled it to be reused again and again. Now, so we've got a bunch of phosphorus in that strip solution. What do we do now? Well, this is a solubility plot from Stumm and Morgan on aquatic chemistry. And what that shows is the high pH of our strip solution, we're about out here, pH 13 to 14. Calcium hydroxyphosphate salts are going to be very insoluble. So if we add a soluble calcium salt like calcium chloride to that strip solution, we're going to precipitate this calcium hydroxyphosphate, and that actually allows us to reuse that strip solution as well and recirculate that. And that allows us to close the recycle loop, because what we've precipitated here, an X-ray diffraction confirms, is a hydroxyl apatite mineral with a little bit of carbonate in it, and it's about 10% phosphorus, 25% P2O5, 54% or so bone phosphate of lime. That's what they use, that expression, when they dig up this material in Florida for phosphate deposits to manufacture fertilizer. That's the material they dig up, and about 55% bone phosphate of lime is suitable to be sent to a factory to be produced in mono or diammonium phosphate commercial phosphorus fertilizers. So we've produced a possibly marketable fertilizer product. As a matter of fact, this is fairly chemically similar to bone meal as well. You plant your tulips, it's a phosphorus source, about 24-25% P in your NPK analysis. Okay, so almost everybody says, well, that all sounds great, but what about water contamination? You're using this waste product from acid mine drainage, and so you're probably going to mess up your water. Okay. Well, we did because of this is a very valid concern. We used what we consider a fairly extreme test conditions, where we took 1 gram per liter of powdered ochre, not the granular material we use in the treatment columns. We shook it for 2 hours. That's a very long contact time. Our typical contact times are on the order of minutes. Analyzed for these elements by ICP, and first off, you see that the ochre is not dissolving, because we'd see lots of iron and aluminum, and we don't in these cases, so the ochre is stable. Also, people would have concerns, what about saltiness? Is it becoming salty? Well, no potassium, no sodium. What we do see is mostly calcium, magnesium, but these are things in mineral water. As a matter of fact, where I live, we have higher calcium concentrations than this in our drinking water. And then the toxics, of course, you need to test for those as well. And they were all very close, near the method detection limit. Now, I should add a caveat. These are all coal mine drainages that we sampled in Pennsylvania. If you went out west to a metal mine drainage, there are some famous ones out west, like the Berkeley Pit in Montana. They're chock full of things like copper, lead, arsenic, cadmium, things like that. Those would probably not be good candidates for this technology, because those elements could be transferred into the drinking water. But the coal mine ochres are much purer, and this shows that the water contamination with those ochres is likely to be not much of a problem. Okay, so we've demonstrated this all on a laboratory scale. What about scaling up? Can you really scale this up? and do it on large scale. We're fortunate to be co-located with an aquaculture broodstock facility that the U.S. Department of Agriculture runs at our site, with a fair number of fish in this facility that they use to raise fish for growth and health studies. We have 150 gallons per minute makeup water, which gives us 150 gallons per minute up to that flow to use as a feed for phosphorus absorption tests on a large scale. Okay, so we said, well, let's give it a shot. Let's try it first. We got to scale this up, right? Let's try it in our little one-inch laboratory column. And we got pretty good results over 50 days of operation. You can see that the input here is very low. As an aquaculture wastewater, the phosphorus content in terms of P is less than 1 milligram per liter, much less, 0.1 to 0.2 in this case. A municipal wastewater would be much higher, say 3 to 5 milligrams per liter. And a dairy wastewater, way up there. But we have what we have, and we got very good results with our pilot test for this, or our one-inch cell, so I said, hey, great, let's scale up. Let's go for it. So we used a 55-gallon drum, and we ran this test up to this point in time, and we stopped right here because although the chemical results were okay, the hydraulics were giving us a nightmare. We initially did most of our tests going upflow, but in this short, fat drum, the water punched a hole through the bed and short-circuited the bed. So we switched to downflow, and then we got all sorts of problems because somehow the water would not pass through that bed. And we were tearing our hair out trying to figure out what was going on. So we backed up a little bit, and we went back to a 4-inch diameter column. Can't see it very well, but this has pressure taps at various heights in the column. We found out that pressure drop all happens at the surface of the media there in a downflow column. And that's due to the formation of microbial biofilm that occurs there. And so you can get around that by back flushing periodically and breaking up that biofilm. And so our chemical results weren't really what we were looking for here. What we were looking for is how do we get stable hydraulics on our reactor. And so we actually went back to the drum, and we made it work under the right conditions. The drum worked okay in an upflow, and we said, okay, we understand how to do this now. Let's scale way up. Let's scale up to something on the order of the size of, say, a small town municipal wastewater treatment. So the first step is we're going to need a lot of media. And so this is from the Blue Valley site. They have a filter there. Allows us to concentrate that media. We spread out in the asphalt and dried it. It's not the right particle size, so we had to bring it back to our lab. We use a vibratory screen and a roll crusher to break that up. You need a dust collector to collect all the dust you're going to generate. Our aquaculture wastewater has particulates, so we use commercial off-the-shelf sand filters to remove those before the fixed bed. In some cases, dissolved gases in the reactor are a problem, so we use a vacuum degasser right here to remove those. And then we pump that through the wall to the tank room. We have six tanks, 36-inch diameter, each filled with 600 pounds of our acetamine drainage media. Particle size is about 5 by 30 mesh. That's about 4 by 0.5 millimeters. Its gravity downflow comes in the top, flows through the tank, then out through the standpipe. We never want air in that bed. Okay? So these are the results we got over our inaugural run last summer. Up to about 45 days, we had almost complete removal of phosphorus. We actually processed for almost half a year, and our overall recovery was 73%. So we were very pleased with that. Our average flow is 53 gallons per minute. That works out to 75,000 gallons per day. You're starting to get into the neighborhood of a commercial wastewater treatment plant, although those can go much bigger, up to, say, 30 million gallons per day for Washington, D.C., but 75,000 gallons a day would be suitable for a small town. Okay, so that's all great, but what if you get dairy wastewater? So we said, well, what could we do with dairy wastewater? Okay, so this would be a different application. It's another talk altogether. I just want to touch on this and show what's possible. This is a 400,000-gallon manure pit. We've added about 10 tons of our ochre And the idea here is to sequester the phosphorus in place. We're converting the phosphorus from a water-soluble form to water-insoluble form, so we can spread it on the field. The rain will not solubilize that phosphorus and take it away. It'll keep it on the field. Okay, that's all the much time I have for that. I'm working with Laura Christensen. We've looked at combined nitrogen-phosphorus removal. And what we found out, we're interested in what happens if you put denitrification in front of or after phosphorus removal. What we found out was it didn't matter that much. By the time we got the residence time, the good residence time for nitrate removal, we got good removal whether it was before or after phosphate removal. Our phosphorus removal down here, good removal either before or after the denitrification step. So this is another paper too, and Laura's going to be talking about this, I'm sure, in the future, and the paper will be coming out hopefully next year. So bottom line, I'll let you read these bullets and I'll summarize. The mine drainage ochre is an effective economical media for the removal of phosphorus from wastewaters, all sorts of wastewaters. It's been demonstrated on a large scale. It allows you to recycle and recover the phosphorus, close that recycle loop, and we feel a very promising technology to be moved out into industry and into the field. Finally, I didn't do this myself, had a lot of help, including Laura Christensen, who I see them, a lot of people here know, and some of the other folks here have helped me over the years with this project. So that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you have, and I hope you do have questions.
Got time for a couple questions.
Yes, in your batch absorption isotope, did you come up with a pH to have it? Is this the pH in comparing all the different iron numbers?
That's a good question. In some cases, they do buffer the pH, but we felt that we are going to be working on, you've got to deal with whatever wastewater you had. And so most of those absorption, all those absorption isotherms I showed you were done in deionized water. What we've done with the Blue Valley media is we looked at what happens if we use our groundwater, Leetown Science Center, which is a calcium bicarbonate solution, essentially. What happens if we use KCl? We didn't see a big difference there for the Blue Valley media. I know that a lot of people do that, and there are reasons, good reasons for doing that, but when you're going to scale it up, it's not going to be economical to adulterate your water source with
that makes sense.
With buffers. Yes, it is. We've done lots of tests, and that's actually a good thing. Oh, okay, right. It's a good thing because you can strip the phosphorus back off at high pH. And some ochres, when you put them in water, they'll give you a fairly low pH, which is actually favorable to those ochres because you get better absorption the lower the pH. And some ochres have a higher pH. And I know a lot of people do. They'll add things like buffers. And I just feel that complicates absorption isotherm. Well, and then we confirmed with the Blue Valley media, we looked at our specific water matrices. We didn't see a lot of difference there. So I agree from an academic point of view, yeah, it's important. I think it depends on what information you want to get from that isotherm.
You want a practical data set, practical comparison.
That's correct. That's what we're going for.
Another question? Okay. Thank you.